This is Black History Month, and much of that history unfolds under the long shadow of white supremacy and segregation. Mike, you wanted to talk today about The Color of Law, a book by Richard Rothstein, who shows how laws in the U.S. have reproduced patterns of de jure segregation rather than de facto segregation. These are two terms associated with the mechanisms of segregation. Before taking up the substance of Rothstein's work, can you explain these two terms and the importance of this distinction he's making?
Well, his book is extraordinary and very important because he demolishes assumptions made by the U.S. Supreme Court and by most of us about how segregation comes about and how it was created here in the United States. De jure segregation is a bad thing, according to the U.S. Supreme Court. It means it's segregation that's legally caused, whether laws separating the races or excluding one race from benefits awarded to another. Whereas de facto segregation is what happens when there's unscrupulous real estate agents or people who, because of their own predilections, live out a life in such a way that they end up picking environments to live in and places to go that exclude other races. And there is not a place where the Constitution goes.
I mean, that's often in the area of unconscious racial biases, that kind of thing.
Yeah. So that's the difference. And what Rothstein's book does in a nutshell, in all great books like Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow on the subject, can be reduced to a nutshell, is that he shows that the myth relied on, the comfortable fiction relied on by the U.S. Supreme Court, that segregation in this country is de facto, is wrong, that there have been explicit laws passed that have shaped neighborhoods and forced people to live in places that they would otherwise not choose to live in because of laws. And he shows how these laws evolved primarily from the 1930s and from the New Deal.
Can you provide some of the key laws that he describes in this trajectory that's important, partly not only as it relates to racism and segregation, but as the accumulation of wealth and the intergenerational transfer of wealth through home ownership?
Well, quick flashback to history. In 1934, when the Federal Housing Agency, or FHA, was created, America was a nation of renters. To buy a house was a tricky thing. Mortgages were limited to 50% of the house's value. The loans were like 3 to 5 years with a giant balloon payment at the end. Only 1 in 10 households in this country owned a house. So what happened was that everything changed in the 30s. The laws were passed allowing the federal government to insure loans. The concept of a 30-year loan was created, 20% down payments. And the insurance of loans enabled banks to lend money extensively. They also, at that time, created public housing, which had not existed before. And there was a series of laws, and particularly important were the financial arrangements that allowed loans to happen, that enabled America to become what it is now, a nation of homeowners. But all these laws were explicitly limited to white people. That was part of the deal of the New Deal, is that it was a coalition of urban workers and intellectuals and Southern segregationists. And the only way Southerners would vote for these laws was if Black people were excluded.
Was this explicit or more in the subtext?
This was very explicit. This was debated, and it was no secret for decades. We now have suppressed how explicitly racist the U.S. was, particularly in the middle of the 20th century. In Oakland, California, for example, you would be kicked off the real estate board for selling a house to a Black person as late as 1967. These laws did not change. These explicitly segregationist laws only changed with the Federal Housing Act of 1968. But by then, shortly thereafter, is when the notion of real property really became a big deal.
The Oregon legislature did a report in 2019 on racial discrimination in lending and found that even 50 years after the Federal Fair Housing Act that you cite, Black people continue to be denied mortgages, charged higher rates during the subprime era and the scandals associated with that. Many of them were disproportionately pushed on Black families. And it does raise the question of how progressive something like the Federal Fair Housing Act of 1969 was. Are these kind of hollow reforms? Can you say something about that and how Rothstein kind of assesses not only the depths of the legal segregation and legal denial of access to one means of achieving and transferring wealth, which is through home ownership to Black people. But how then do we assess that period of reforms and that did not deliver much? But does that mean they are simply hollow or a facade in a certain sense?
Not at all. The reforms have made things better. They've certainly not made things perfect. But the explicit de jure segregation that lasted until 1968 shaped everything in a way that's really hard to rearrange. Let's look at what happened. I mean, in the 40s, you could buy a house in Levittown right after World War II for $8,000. That was its equivalent now of about $100,000.
Where's Levittown?
It's right out of New York City. Uh-huh. It's a Levittown in Pennsylvania as well. The suburbs were built for white people. And at that time, people didn't realize the import of these houses because housing was just no big thing. You could buy a house with a year or two's income. You know, houses were $20,000 as late as the late 60s in California, as well as everywhere else. In Oregon, houses were $10,000, $15,000, $20,000. And Black people had plenty of work after World War II. They could easily afford these houses, but they were not allowed to buy them. They were simply excluded from suburbs all over the country. Now, that's at a time when America's work was manufacturing primarily, and Black people have always had a much easier time getting jobs manufacturing than in face-forward positions like bank tellers, where banks would be reluctant to hire them. So there was plenty of money around and plenty of efforts.
And a lot of the unionization of industrial jobs allowed many Black people to enter, in a sense, the middle class.
Yes. But what happened is, right in the early 70s, that's when the whole concept of real property took on the power that it has today. It meant really little before that. You could be a janitor and afford to buy a house. Anybody could buy a house if you chose to in almost any part of this country, until the 70s, the 1970s. At that time, real estate took off. And now it's at the place where even well-to-do white young people cannot afford a house. Houses have become objects of incredible value. They've gone up in value hundreds of times. I mean, I know that this group that I was working for, a prisoners union, bought a three-story Victorian house in San Francisco for $35,000 in 1975. Is now worth over $2 million. Houses have gone up. Even those Levittown houses that were worth sold initially for $8,000 are now worth about $300,000, $350,000. There have been a massive appreciation of assets. Along with the loss of jobs, the manufacturing jobs, there's been asset inflation of every sort of asset, stocks, but primarily real estate. And that is the main source of intergenerational wealth. So at this present time, white people make about, let me turn it around, Black people make about 60% of what white people do in their work, but they have about 5% of the wealth. That's almost entirely due to the fact that they have been excluded from housing, which is the source of, as you say, intergenerational wealth.
And these are compounding effects over time that explain the widening income inequality and race and class divide in this country.
Yes. And Rothstein shows how many other forms of law, for example, zoning, how zoning, you know, toxic industries or waste-filled industries were excluded from white areas, but not from Black areas. He shows how public housing was explicitly race-based. He shows how restrictive covenants continued, that is, covenants that forbade anyone from selling a house to a Black person, were in effect until the 60s. And finally, he shows that, well, one of the many little pleasures of the book, he shows that the idea that Black people moving in to a neighborhood would lower the property values was precisely wrong. What typically happened, Black people have been forced, because of the restricted access to housing, to pay more for their houses than white people have. So what has happened in neighborhoods around Chicago, for example, is that a Black person would move in, would pay more, and then rumors would be spread by real estate agents who would get white houses at a discounted rate for fear that there would be a Black invasion. And then those same houses would be sold to African Americans for more money than they would have been worth previously. So consistently, there's an effect of improvement in the property values where Black people are allowed to buy homes.
And many of these same patterns, of course, have been documented in Oregon. There are some really wonderful exhibits, including online lectures through the Oregon Historical Society that listeners may want to check out during Black History Month. So, Mike, in closing, what are the implications of this sobering history that, of course, the move now to ban books around the country that make white people uncomfortable? This is probably on that list. It can make you very uncomfortable, especially realizing the cumulative effects of this. And then the question is, what are the implications of this for forms of reparation and not only being disturbed and shocked, but what do we have a moral obligation to do in response to this form of legally sanctioned segregation and white supremacy?
It's hard. It's a lot harder than changing drug laws or getting rid of the death penalty or changing criminal justice laws. It's because now it's so ingrained and embedded. The whole phenomenon of asset inflation was in effect beginning in the 70s and continuing to today. You know, it started after things were set in stone, in that the suburbs, which are now passing ordinances constantly trying to keep other places from being built in them or around them, it's really difficult. It's an area that cries out for remedies, but it's the most difficult of all.
So,
any snappy answer. I do know that the reparations, the notion of reparations, people think of slavery, but when you think that Black people were legally deprived of hundreds of billions of dollars of value because of explicit laws, then you think reparations is a more modern concept than most people suppose.
So with that, we close for today and continue to follow this. It's in a way promising that the movement for reparations has gained some not only moral legitimacy, but political legitimacy in recent years.
It has to begin with a recognition of how systematically our laws and the formal structures of society have deprived Black people of massive amounts of wealth before we can even start to do anything about it.
Thanks, Mike. We'll continue to follow this.